Thank you. This morning I'll be talking about needle syringe programs and opiate substitution programs in low and middle income countries. We have no conflicts of interest to report. Unfortunately, our type of research doesn't generate conflicts of interest. We're trying to find some way of developing one in case we run out of NIH money. This study was supported by the NIH, particularly the Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, as part of their Methods for Prevention Packages program. Our objectives were to assess current structural level needle syringe program and opiate substitution programs in low and middle income countries, examining overall retention of participants in OST program and changes in biomarkers, HIV and HCV, among participants in needle and syringe programs. Most high-income countries have shown remarkable effectiveness in reducing HIV transmission among people who inject drugs through NSP programs and OST programs. However, we do not yet have a good understanding of what happens in low and middle income countries. There are multiple issues, challenges faced in low and middle income countries. The first, of course, is the funding for these programs can be severely limited. The second major challenge is that there's often a lack of trained staff for proper implementation of the programs, that even if you have the money to put on a program, you might not be able to find the appropriate staff. There's also the issues of following good clinical practices for needle syringe programs and opiate substitution programs in low and middle income countries. You often find restrictions on the number of syringes that can be exchanged, or restrictions on methadone dosages, or a lack of take-home dosages for methadone treatment. There's also the problem of severe stigmatization of drug users and HIV in many low and middle income countries that may discourage use of the programs, that even if you have an excellent program there, people who need the program may not come because they're afraid to be identified as either using drugs or having HIV or being at risk for HIV. Okay. We basically did a standard systematic literature review following the PRISMA guidelines. Our selection criteria for the NSP programs was that there had to be at least 50% coverage for people who inject drugs and at least 10 to 15 syringes exchanged per injector per year. So we wanted to look at large-scale structural programs. We did not want to look at simply pilot programs. For the OST programs, we included both methadone and buprenorphine, and they had to measure retention over time among participants. Okay. Retention in methadone and buprenorphine treatment is considered to be the best single indicator of success for the program. It correlates very highly with improvement during treatment and improvement after treatment. The primary studies were selected along with national surveillance reports for HIV, for newly diagnosed cases of HIV among people who inject drugs. We required that the data had to be recorded during the expansion of needle syringe programs or during OST treatment, not either prior to or simply after the programs were implemented. For the NSP studies, they had to include at least 95% injectors in the study sample. The OST studies had to include opiate users, but we permitted both injecting and non-injecting opiate users. We found 12 studies of needle syringe programs and 63 studies of opiate substitution treatment programs that met our criteria. These were from 17 different low and middle income countries, including Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Brazil, China, the Republic of Georgia, India, Indonesia, Iran, Kyrgyzstan, Lithuania, Malaysia, Mauritius, Taiwan, Tanzania, Thailand, Ukraine, and Vietnam. So we feel we got actually pretty good geographic representation of low and middle income countries. For the NSP programs, in 7 of the 9 locations that used HIV prevalence, there was a decrease after implementation of the NSP programs. For the 3 locations that analyzed HCV prevalence, all reported decreases, and one site where they analyzed HCV incidence, there was stabilization of HCV incidence during the implementation and expansion of the NSP. 3 of the 4 countries with national surveillance data for HIV cases showed decreases in association with the NSP implementation and expansion. This graphically shows HIV prevalence during expansion of the NSP programs. You can see there's 2 countries where HIV prevalence increased, and in all the rest, HIV prevalence decreased after implementation of the NSP programs. This shows graphically the HCV prevalence. In all 3 sites, HCV prevalence decreased after expansion of the needle and syringe programs. For the OST programs, we found similar retention after 12 months compared to high-income countries, that in both cases, about 50% of patients were retained at 12 months. In our low-middle-income countries, which is pretty much the standard in high-income countries, retention was slightly higher for programs that used methadone compared to buprenorphine at 12 months, but this was not statistically significant. Although the dosage of medication varied slightly among the studies, there was no significant relationship between dosage and retention, although all of the programs were following WHO guidelines for opiate substitution treatment, so we didn't have any programs that were in violation of the WHO guidelines. This shows the treatment retention by buprenorphine and in yellow and methadone in blue. You can see that there's great variation in retention in the initial months, but once you get out to 12 or greater than 12 months, retention is actually quite good. The majority of our NSP studies did document reductions in bloodborne infection. There were a few exceptions. In Lithuania, there was a decrease in the initial years of NSP, and then there was an increase in the last year when the needle syringe programs were dramatically reduced because of a funding problem. Late implementation of needle syringe programs in Brazil, Porto Alegre, Brazil, was attributed as the cause of the increase in HCV prevalence during needle syringe program expansion. And in Dhaka, the early implementation of NSP led to initial reductions in bloodborne infection, followed by an increase that was attributed to sexual transmission, not needle-borne transmission. So that we basically have some understanding of where the programs were not effective. In the OST programs, basically they have reached the level of 50% retention that's used as an indicator of success for OST programs. Retention in OST programs has been associated with many positive outcomes, including a better adherence to ART and more frequent initiation for HIV-positive drug users, higher levels of virologic response to ART, and reduced crime and increased legal employment among drug users. There are a number of limitations that should be mentioned. For the NSP programs, the reduction in bloodborne infections cannot be attributed solely to the NSP programs. There were a number of other factors going on, including loss of HIV positives to the population due to deaths, access to drug treatment, and other harm reduction programs that may have occurred simultaneously with the expansion of the OST that were not fully reported in the studies we reviewed. Also, many low and middle income countries have started these programs only in the last 5 to 10 years. Therefore, we don't have great longitudinal data for evaluation of these programs. These systematic reviews presenting here are basically in our initial evaluation. And in the OST programs, retention could have been influenced by other factors also, including participation in other harm reduction programs. However, we do have some initial conclusions that if implemented on a large scale and according to WHO guidelines, HIV prevention programs and harm reduction programs for drug users in low and middle income countries appear to be as successful as in high-income countries, both in retaining people over time and in reducing bloodborne infections. These programs are gaining wider acceptance in low- and middle-income countries, and there have been many pilot programs implemented that now need to be scaled up to public health programs. The implementation clearly should be done according to good clinical practices. This does remain a critical issue. Getting the implementation up to a public health scale remains an issue. Sustainability is an issue, particularly as international funding declines. PEPFAR is moving from a direct services to a country ownership model. The Global Fund is having difficulties in raising money, so that even though we're seeing early success for these large-scale programs, sustaining them will be an issue. And finally, continued monitoring and evaluation will be needed. Okay. some of this material is either in press or in publication, and we'd like to note that we use the World Bank definitions for low and middle income countries. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all the presenters for a great presentation. Before I open up the floor for questions and comments, I just have a quick announcement on behalf of International Health Section. We do have all the activities of International Health Section available at our welcome booth next to the housing and ADA booth. We are right there. And I would like to invite everyone to the social hour tonight from 6 to 8 in 258B. So I wanted to invite all of you. I would like to open the floor for comments and questions, please. Yes, please. You want to come here? And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a better idea.
It's a very interesting presentation because, I work for HIV AIDS and IDU programs in my country, and I found actually the Dr. Robert and Dr. John's presentation very interesting. So I first like to have a question for Dr. Robert?
Crawford.
Yeah. Crawford. So it's very interesting because it's in northern Thailand, and it's bordering with my country, and some of the ethnic, most of the ethnic groups are from Burma. I would like to know why the study is you study between Thai and the ethnic minorities, and this is my first question. And next question is whether you also study the cross-border health implementation on HIV/AIDS between Thailand and Burma.
Okay, thank you. Well, we focused generally on the communities in Thailand, and we didn't want to exclude anyone. And so that's why, although our partners were Thai partners, because of the fact of, like, we're interested in also, like, working towards human rights and access to health for all, we wanted to determine what the information needs were of the ethnic minority communities in addition, especially because they have no access to health care, no access to education, unless, like, a non-governmental organization goes in, like the Christian Law Center, and provides that. But that's often only provided to those that have migrated to the city and have jobs in the city. And the second question, unfortunately, we did not look at that. But that's an excellent point and something that I definitely think should be pursued.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for Dr. Don, I was expecting, you know, if I can see in the low and middle income country whether Burma is included, but you didn't include. Why?
Okay. We did a systematic review of published studies and studies that had been presented at major international conferences. We did not find any studies of syringe exchange program or opiate substitution countries, programs from Burma. So we only reviewed studies where results have been published or at least presented at international conferences. And so we, unfortunately, we did not find any studies from Burma. Hopefully, that met our criteria of it had to be a large needle syringe program and there had to be retention data if it was an OST program. But hopefully, within the next several years, there will be published studies from Burma.
I hope so too.
Yeah. The selection criteria was based on studies in the research literature, and not all low middle income countries have conducted studies and published results or at least presented them at conferences.
Okay.
Thank you.
I mean, there are two issues. One is sexual transmission within the population of people who use drugs. And then there's the issue of sexual transmission from people who use drugs to their sexual partners who don't necessarily use drugs. And right now it looks like the best thing you can do is try to, as fast as possible, reduce needle-borne transmission. That if you can reduce the number of people who inject drugs who are HIV positive, that reduces the number of HIV positives who can transmit to other injectors or transmit to non-injecting sexual partners. And we pretty much know how to do that effectively, and those programs have an effect really within short time periods, 1 to 2 years, that in the HIV prevalence data on that one slide, you could see prevalence was going down actually fairly rapidly. So in terms of reducing sexual transmission, first you want to reduce needle-borne transmission as fast as possible. Then you, at the same time, you want to try to increase condom use. That is much more difficult. All of these certain needle syringe programs were also distributing condoms, but it's harder to get people to use condoms than to get them to use clean needles. The issue of stigmatization becomes more important. That I know in a number of programs that do distribute condoms, it is hard to get sexual partners to come to a syringe exchange and pick up condoms. You often find many people who inject drugs don't even tell their sexual partner about it because of stigmatization. So the progress there is certainly possible, but it appears to be a much longer term challenge, that where you can get people to change their needle use behavior very quickly and very dramatically, changing their sexual behavior is much more of a challenge. In some literature reviews we're doing now, it looks like HIV positives are more likely to change their sexual behavior. So providing voluntary counseling and testing for HIV may be another important factor for reducing sexual risk behavior.